Hello, everyone. I'm your moderator for this installment of Podcast 360, Amanda Balbi with Pulmonology Consultant. More than 11 million Americans have been diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, according to estimates from the American Lung Association. November is COPD Awareness Month, and in doing our part in raising awareness, we're joined by two women who will be answering our questions about COPD. Dr. Meilan K. Han is a member of the Scientific Advisory Committee, an ACRC principal investigator, and a national spokesperson for the American Lung Association. And Deborah P. Brown is the Chief Mission Officer at the American Lung Association. Thank you, ladies, for joining me today.
Thank you.
COPD is a group of lung diseases that includes chronic bronchitis and emphysema. It affects nearly 11 million Americans, but how many people in New Jersey struggle with COPD?
Approximately 437,000 individuals in New Jersey have COPD, which means that they or someone they know may be living with this chronic lung disease and experiencing shortness of breath that interferes with planned activities. And living with a chronic lung disease and the stress of struggling to breathe can be very taxing for both the individual and their loved one.
Let's talk about the diagnosis of COPD. Which genes can identify COPD, and what tests can be performed to identify these genes?
Well, this is a really good question, and I think certainly within the community can cause some confusion. But COPD is typically diagnosed using spirometry, and it's characterized by airflow obstruction. Now, certainly there are other things that can cause airflow obstruction, but some of the things that we know are associated with COPD include tobacco smoke exposure, whether that's primary or secondhand, but other occupational exposures as well can cause COPD. We do know that there are probably a host of genes that can contribute to either reduced lung function or more rapid lung function decline. But the only gene that really in clinical practice that we can test for is something that causes a very unique form of COPD called alpha-1 antitrypsin. Deficiency in this protein can lead to early onset emphysema. And so this is a test that physicians can run in the office and is something that physicians should think about if a patient does have airflow obstruction, particularly if they're younger or if it's hard to identify other risk factors. But there are very specific treatments for patients with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. The rest of the genes that we're beginning to understand may be associated with COPD are not something that really a physician can test for in the office.
Let's move on to how these patients are managed. What management strategies can slow progression of COPD?
So that's also a really good question and something that as an academic community, we're really trying to grapple with right now. The most important thing that a patient with COPD can do to try to slow progression of lung disease is to reduce exposures. So if that's tobacco smoke, reducing exposure to tobacco smoke is incredibly important. Unfortunately, none of the medications that we have right now, and that would include mostly inhaled medications, although there is one pill that's FDA approved for COPD, but none of these really have been shown definitively to slow the loss of lung function over time. They certainly can help patients feel better, and they can certainly reduce the frequency of flare-ups and improve exercise capacity. We do know that in appropriate patients, oxygen may improve survival. And in severe cases, there are surgical options. So really, the most important things for patients with COPD in terms of slowing progression really is avoidance or reduction of risk factors.
Dr. Han points out that oxygen therapy is common among COPD patients. Deb, what tips does the American Lung Association have for pulmonologists in caring for patients on oxygen therapy?
Well, pulmonologists can make sure that individuals know the importance of using oxygen therapy, particularly when they begin living with oxygen therapy. So a couple tips are safety. So while oxygen therapy is safe, it does contribute to flammability as materials in oxygen-enriched environments burn more readily. So proper storage along with avoiding aerosols, heats, and flames will help the patient keep safe. When a patient is traveling with supplemental oxygen, we want to make sure that whether it's by car, train, plane, or boat, that they connect with the mode of transportation prior to their departure to learn their policies and procedures for carrying oxygen. And we'll also want to make sure that once the patient arrives, that they have access to additional oxygen once they reach their destination. And then support. Sometimes a question about oxygen therapy is really too complex for someone to look up on the internet. So encourage patients who have additional questions to contact a registered nurse or respiratory therapist and counselors at the American Lung Association's Lung Helpline. And that's available at 1-800-LUNG-USA or through our chat mode, which is lung.org/helpline. And they can get accurate and detailed information. And if they have additional questions, they can call back in to the same specialist, and that will help them. They can also join a local Better Breathers Club or our Inspire community, and that will help them learn additional information as well.
What are Better Breathers Clubs? And can you tell us more about Inspire?
Sure. So finding a support system helps to make living with a chronic lung disease like COPD a little bit easier. And so the American Lung Association's Better Breathers Clubs bring together individuals with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, lung cancer, interstitial pulmonary fibrosis, or other lung diseases, really to talk about managing their symptoms through everyday life. And the clubs are led by trained facilitators. These in-person adult support groups are located in communities across the country to help those living with a lung disease live life to its fullest. And they can go to lung.org and type in Better Breathers Clubs, and the list of clubs will pop up so that they can see what's in their community. We also have an inspire.com community, and the American Lung Association supports several free online communities for patients and caregivers, and that includes the lung cancer survivors, living with COPD, living with lung disease, living with pulmonary fibrosis, caring for pulmonary fibrosis, and living with asthma. And we also support Acquit Now, which is Freedom from Smoking, which is a community of people who are trying to quit tobacco. And we find that it's really important to host these support communities because patients are able to speak freely with a trusted and supporting group, and that can really positively impact their health.
Telemedicine is another management strategy that's becoming more popular. Can remote monitoring of COPD patients help reduce exacerbations or admission rates?
So telemedicine is sort of a hot area right now, but I think it's important for the audience to understand that that encompasses quite a few different things. So when you say telemedicine, that could be a provider talking to a patient in lieu of having them come to a specialty center. It could also, though, mean that that's a way follow-up or sort of disease management is handled. It turns out a lot of our patients in the U.S. with COPD actually live in rural areas. And so the concept of telemedicine makes a lot of sense. I think in particular, getting, for instance, specialty or specialist input on their case. And it's actually something that we're looking at here at the University of Michigan. Unfortunately, to my knowledge, the studies that have looked at telemedicine sort of in disease management, for instance, having a case manager or a nurse call, have not actually been shown to help reduce exacerbation or admission rates. That doesn't mean that it certainly can't be helpful. I think about one recent large study that was published in particular. I don't think the data is perhaps robust yet. However, I do think that there are certainly areas where it makes a lot of sense. Another challenge that we have to managing patients with COPD is getting them into pulmonary rehabilitation. Again, we have a lot of patients in rural areas, and there really aren't a lot of pulmonary rehabilitation programs in rural areas. There have been groups that have been looking at whether exercise programs could be potentially administered remotely. I think the data on that is still accumulating, but because of the nature of the COPD patient population in the U.S., I think it's definitely something that we're still sort of exploring.
What new drug therapies for COPD are on the horizon?
Certainly, there's new drugs that are being looked at every day. Unfortunately, the last slew of medications that were recently looked at for COPD, and here I'm thinking about some of the biologic therapies that had been shown to be efficacious in asthma. Two of those recently went through large phase 3 clinical trial programs to see if they would have efficacy in COPD. And so unfortunately, those did not succeed in phase 3 studies. And so I'm actually not aware of anything sort of right on the horizon. But there are a lot of novel compounds that right now that are being looked at in what I would say is sort of phase 2, early phase 3. There are some phase 3 studies that are just starting. So looking at a couple of different novel mechanisms, but I think it's going to be a couple of years out still before I can tell you that we've got something that's really imminent for patients. So I think for right now, we need patients to continue to work closely with their doctors on the therapies that we do have. And that includes long-acting bronchodilators and long-acting inhaled corticosteroids, which may be appropriate for some patients. That may also include, there is a pill that's FDA approved for patients with COPD, which is a PDE4 inhibitor, and may help to reduce the frequency of flare-ups, particularly for patients who have chronic bronchitis. So I wish that we had some new therapies that were sort of on the cusp, but I'm afraid it's probably going to be a few years out before we have anything that's really worth talking about.
Can you discuss a few case examples of the different types of COPD and how they're diagnosed?
So this really gets at the issue that COPD is somewhat of an umbrella term. So what it most commonly refers to is airflow obstruction that has developed often in association with tobacco, but not necessarily. Again, we know that other exposures can cause COPD, and in some cases, there are genetic risk factors that also are playing a role. But there really is no specific formally recognized category for what I would call subtypes of COPD. They're being actively researched. Well, there's a few subtypes that matter. When I say that matter, I mean that matter for therapies that are currently available. We may have subtypes in the future that matter for therapies that are being developed, and I absolutely hope that that's the case. But for right now, the subtypes that matter are patients that have chronic bronchitis or sputum production. And honestly, that's just a question that we ask patients. And those patients are unique in that they may benefit from the PDE4 inhibitor that I mentioned. The other subtype of patient that may benefit for very specific therapies are patients with emphysema. So airflow obstruction develops due to a combination of either small airway abnormality, where the airways either get thickened and fibrosed, and actually in some cases actually disappear, but that ultimately develops into emphysema, where there's actually loss of the lung tissue. And for patients with emphysema, there actually are a couple of very specific therapies that have now been FDA approved. One of those is lung volume reduction surgery. So for patients with upper lobe predominant emphysema who have low exercise capacity after a course of pulmonary rehabilitation, those patients may benefit from lung volume reduction surgery where the upper portion of the lungs is taken out. Now, interestingly, there was another therapy for patients with emphysema that was just approved by the FDA over the summer. And that is actually a valve therapy that is placed via bronchoscopy. The patients that would qualify for this are also patients with emphysema, although patients can potentially be considered for this valve therapy with a slightly different distribution of emphysema than patients for the classic lung volume reduction surgery. Although it is sort of the same concept where a portion of the lung that's hyperinflated but not functioning very well is degassed and it's sort of made non-functional, but it's also collapsed with this one-way valve such that the functioning part of the lung can actually work better. And so the way to find out whether a patient would qualify for either of these procedures would be to be seen at a specialty center that does these procedures, and they would typically start with something called a high-resolution CT scan that can actually quantify both the amount and location of emphysema. And then either the pulmonary teams or the surgical teams would go from there to determine whether those patients qualify. Now, from a research perspective, there are some other what I would call sort of subtypes of COPD, but really the ones that I just mentioned are the most clinically important because those are the ones that have very specific therapies associated with them.
Great. Thank you both again for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Sure. My pleasure.